are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, February 18th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. I am out in California doing Mark Maron's show entitled Maron for a couple days. My daughter's pissed because it's her vacation. I was supposed to be spending time with her, but come on. We have for you today an interview I did with Professor Amanda Frost on back in 2012. This was when the Affordable Care Act was in front of the Supreme Court in its arguments. There were arguments, I guess it's not moot court. The court was having arguments as to the fate of the Affordable Care Act in 2012, and Professor Frost is on the law school faculty at American University. And the thing to pay attention here too is our conversation about the expansion of Medicaid, because that's the one that really ended up being a shocker for everyone. I'm doing that, of course, because in a week or so, or 2 weeks from today, I'll be down in Washington, D.C. for the Supreme Court arguments about King versus Burwell, which is the next big Affordable Care Act case and could have major implications. Also, a conversation I had with John McDonough from the January of 2014 regarding the challenges facing single payer in Vermont since that time, I guess about a month ago, a year later, Vermont abandoned their attempts at instituting single payer health care. We've talked about the reasons why, but I thought it'd be interesting to take a look back on what the challenges were perceived as a year ago. A little more than a year ago. And then, for members, an exchange between Mark Maron and I from a 2006 episode of the Sam Steeter Show on Air America. But Maron was filling in for me. So I was actually calling into the show. Weird, I know, but true. So this is my show on Air America, hosted by Mark Maron, with me as a guest. All right, folks, enjoy that. Tomorrow on the program, a new interview with Rick Perlstein on privatization and Chicago. But here is Amanda Frost, John McDonough, and for members, an exchange between Mark Maron and I. Okay, continuing our coverage of the Supreme Court oral arguments regarding the Affordable Care Act as we speak. Literally, as we speak, I believe, the Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments as to the question of the Affordable Care Act's mandate being constitutional. This is day two of the oral arguments. With me now is Amanda Frost. She is a member of the American Constitution Society, professor of law at the American University Washington College of Law. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let me just push that microphone a little closer if I could. First off, let's just talk briefly about the American Constitution Society. This is sort of the left response to the Federalist Society, which, of course, is the Federalist Society, I guess, started in the early 80s.
Yeah, I'm not sure of the background specifics of the Federalist Society, nor should I speak definitively about the American Constitution Society and its purpose. But my understanding of it and the reason I joined it is because I think of it as a group that looked at what the Federalist Society was doing and said, that's useful and a worthy thing to be doing, and we need to have a voice on the left or progressive side doing that as well.
And it's interesting because we're now facing what some have called sort of the most significant case since probably Bush v. Gore. I don't know if that's exactly correct in the context of the law, but I think the similarities are there in terms of people are really wondering how much of the consideration of this case is going to be a function of case law and of precedent versus an outcome that the judges are more inclined to be predisposed towards. Give me your sense of that.
Sure. So is it law or is it politics? And I think my answer is, in many cases, and I think most cases in the Supreme Court, there's a mixture of legal analysis and ideology and normative preferences that help decide cases. And frankly, I think that's appropriate because law is a human endeavor. It's about how we're going to organize our society, and the Constitution is intended to be a very broadly written document that guides our government but doesn't dictate specifics. And I think important questions like this always turn on both considerations. That said, the court will absolutely be looking at the law, both the language of the statute and the language of the Constitution. And I don't think of this as a purely political case. I think this is a case where they will look at what the Constitution allows and the precedent and try to figure out the answer from that.
Now, there are four separate elements to this case. The first was the oral arguments took place yesterday. That was whether or not essentially the plaintiffs had standing, could bring this case at this time. Give me your sense, and this it primarily focused on whether or not the penalties involved in not fulfilling the mandate were a tax or some type of other levy, and whether or not the Tax Injunction Act of 1867.
Yep.
Give me your sense of the, I presume you've listened to the oral arguments.
Yes.
Give me your sense of how that went and what was being set up, if anything was being set up for the next couple of oral arguments.
Sure. And the justices didn't give us too much of a hint about how they feel on the main issue of the case, which is being heard today, which is whether the individual mandate is constitutional. But I think we did get a sense of how they're feeling about whether the Anti-Injunction Act will prevent the court from hearing the case. And the sense that I and a lot of other people took from that argument is that they want to reach the merits. And that's not too surprising because of the fact that none of the parties want them to wait and stay their hand and not reach the merits either. Even the Obama administration, defending the law, says go ahead and decide these important constitutional issues. They don't want this Tax Anti-Injunction Act to prevent the court from hearing the case. The court had to appoint an amicus to make that argument, and while I think he did an able job, they were skeptical.
Let me just explain for the audience what that means. Essentially, there was no one to argue that nobody had standing here, and so the court actually sort of appointed an attorney to make that argument to them.
Yes, yes. And that suggests that a lot of people think it would be a better idea for the country as a whole if the court could reach the merits of the case rather than put it off.
Has there been many instances where the court will accept a case for 3 days? I mean, I don't think there's been many instances where there's been 3 days of oral arguments, but to accept this case, the subsidiary questions, and then
to find that there's no standing seems to be to go a long way to get to go nowhere.
Yes, it would be. It would seem like a much ado about nothing if they, at the end of the day, they said we can't decide this case. That said, I think that's actually an example of how they are. The court is not just like our elected branches. They are a court that looks at legal questions, and they feel they need to take seriously this question of whether a federal statute passed by Congress, which says you're not supposed to challenge taxes until after they are collected, whether that statute means we have to wait till 2015 to challenge this law. And let me just point out quickly, Congress could get rid of that issue in a minute. And in fact, since there's bipartisan consensus that indeed the court should hear the merits, I'm sort of surprised and wish that Congress would
How could they do that?
They could pass an amendment to the Tax Anti-Injunction Act that said it doesn't apply to the legal challenges to the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
And that would clearly get rid of the issue. And they could do it now, by the way. It's not too late.
Now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
My understanding is that at one point during the oral arguments, Chief Justice Roberts sort of poo-pooed the idea that this was a tax. In terms of it falling under this act. Now, the implications of that are not just on yesterday's oral arguments, but on today's oral arguments, because there's two elements to the, or I should say there are two sort of, there's a plan A argument for lay people and a plan B argument on behalf of the Obama administration as to the legality of the mandate. The first has to do with the Commerce Clause. The second has to do with it being a tax. Was John Roberts at least signaling that Plan B is not going to wash? We're going to address this on Plan A.
Yes, and by the way, I think most people thought this would, if they reach the merits, it will get resolved on Plan A, which is whether Congress has the authority under the Commerce Clause to enact this piece of legislation. The government's fallback argument, and it's the argument they give much less time in their briefs, is that it's also justified as part of the taxing power. And I think you're right. Some of the questions yesterday suggested some skepticism about that argument because, as you said, the Chief Justice and other justices seemed to be skeptical of the idea that it was a tax rather than a penalty for not getting health insurance.
What would, before we get to that sort of the Plan A, and forgive my non-legalese vernacular, what would have made it constitute a tax? If it was a government-run program like Social Security or Medicare, in that case, would it be just sort of no doubt about it? It's a tax, and there's no issue here.
Well, what's interesting, and I found this interesting listening to the arguments on this, is there isn't a definition of tax even in the tax code. So in some degree, it's a question of cobbling together a bunch of sources to think about whether something's a tax. Now, there are arguments that this is a tax. For instance, as the amicus making this point said, it is collected in just the same way a tax is collected, and the IRS is responsible for collecting it, and that would suggest it looks like a tax. The reason it looks like a penalty is because you only pay it if you don't get health insurance, so that's not normally how taxes work. And, you know, we could go back and forth on all the ways in which it differs from a tax and all the way it looks similar. I think it's an interesting question because there isn't a definition of tax that we can clearly rely on. And so there's arguments on both sides.
And in this instance, in fact, my understanding is that the IRS does not have the capacity to put you in jail in the way they might if you refuse to pay another tax.
Yeah. So there are some differences in the way that it's well, I think there's some differences in what happens to you if you don't pay it. But I think that there are a lot of similarities in terms of the way it's collected, which is part of why the amicus was arguing that the Anti-Injunction Act should
And theoretically, apply here. I guess the IRS could, and I don't want to get too bogged down in this, but the IRS could just apply it in the same way they do the mortgage deduction, for instance. If you have health care, then you don't need to pay this tax, I guess, in some respects. All right, so let's move on to the argument that the Obama administration is saying that under the Commerce Clause, Congress has the ability to compel purchase of health insurance. Explain to us what the theory is behind that and perhaps what the case law that supports that.
Sure. So the Obama administration's argument is that the Commerce Clause power, along with Congress's power to make laws that are necessary and proper to accomplish other constitutional goals, that together those two provisions of the Constitution authorize this individual mandate, this minimum coverage provision, which requires that anyone who can afford it, who doesn't have health insurance, has to purchase at least minimum coverage. And their argument is this is regulating commerce because, indeed, everyone even those who are young, healthy, and with no health insurance, are indeed affecting the market for health care and imposing costs on the rest of us. What they're doing is they're externalizing the cost of their own health care treatment. And there's a lot of facts and figures in the government's brief to back this up. The average family pays about $1,000 more a month in health insurance costs to cover those who are uninsured. The uninsured inevitably go see doctors at some point in their life, and the statistics on each year how many people go, it's about $50 billion of uncompensated costs every year by the uninsured. They are imposing costs on those with insurance, and we have a system, and I'm glad we have this system, that says to people without insurance, if you are ill, we will treat you, even when you can't pay for it out of pocket or with insurance. That's a good thing, I think, but it also means that the rest of us have, those of us with insurance, have to pay those costs. So the people without insurance are part of the healthcare market, and the argument by the government is we're simply regulating that market by telling them they need to get insurance.
I want to play devil's advocate for a moment, but before I do that, $1,000 a month,
$1,000 a year, I apologize.
$1,000 in additional insurance costs. I also imagine that there's also taxpayer costs because that money is also sort of filtering into Medicare. I mean, those extra added costs are being subsidized through Medicare as well in some regards, in the sense that whatever procedure I'm using it to treat someone without insurance, I'm also going to pass some of that in terms of increased costs for delivering care to Medicare, not just the private insurance industry. So we're sort of getting it on both ends.
Certainly.
All right. So if the idea is that by not buying insurance, the rest of us are subsidizing their choice, presuming ultimately they're going to get sick. Just about everybody does at one point. Couldn't you make that same argument as to, you know, my computer would be significantly cheaper if everybody bought a computer?
Yeah, and I think the big difference there is, unlike other commodities or services, there's no law that would require the people selling computers to sell you one even though you can't afford to buy it. So if someone without insurance gets sick and they show up at the hospital, there's laws and professional ethical requirements that doctors treat that person. But if somebody has no money to buy a computer and decides suddenly they really need one, and they walk into a store and say, I have no money, give me a computer, we know what will happen. You know, the salesperson would laugh. You don't get a computer.
So health insurance, or health care, I should say, is already a specific type of service. It's in a different class than your ability to buy any other type of commodity.
Exactly.
So in some regards, it's not a commodity. I mean, there's something to the idea that the Affordable Care Act is making a public or a more explicit acknowledgement that healthcare is a right. Is that?
I think that goes maybe beyond I wouldn't necessarily use that language, but I think as a society, we have decided that we do not want to be a society that turns away people at the door of a hospital when they're dying. And again, I'm glad that's the case, and I'm glad to be part of that society. And I think the answer is because we have a national consensus that the very sick get treated whether or not they have insurance. And of course, there are a few people that disagree with that, but I would say that's a pretty deep consensus. We then have to deal with the outcome of that, which is we need to find ways to afford to cover everybody.
How do we express that special status in the law? Yeah. In other words, I mean, I can say a computer is a commodity. Yeah. I have no right to it. I can't show up to the Mac store and say, you know, this thing's getting heavy and it's seizing up on me. I'd like to get a MacBook Air, which is a hint to my audience. But, how do we identify healthcare as being different from a computer, other than we sort of feel it should be, and it is in some respect? But is there a specific legal status?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's a specific legal status as much as it is, and this I think the government did a good job of in their briefs, in explaining to the court, look, the economics of healthcare are different than the economics of purchasing a computer or a car or broccoli. Everyone uses the broccoli example. Can the government make you buy broccoli if they can make you buy health insurance? And the answer is no, because unlike the markets for broccoli and computers and cars, the healthcare market has broken down in the sense that we do provide everyone with services at the end of the day, and we need to find a way to afford to cover them. And unlike computers and cars and broccoli, we're not providing people with those commodities for free when they need them. So what's going on is there's a cost shift between the people who don't have insurance are shifting the costs onto the people that do. I misspoke before. It's the when I said $1,000 a month, that's too high. But $1,000 a year is what families are paying as a result of the fact families with insurance are paying in addition to what they would pay because of the fact that there are uninsured people using the healthcare system.
So if I'm a member of the Federalist Society and I have an issue with this, really what I should be doing is going back to that law that mandates you need to cover people when they walk into a hospital, regardless of their capacity to pay, because that is where I really have my genuine problem, because that is the element which changes the nature of this market.
Exactly. And what's interesting about that is none of the opponents of this law have denied that Congress could pass a law. They don't say it's beyond Congress's Commerce Clause authority to say you don't give people health care when they walk in and they're dying. So that's a solution that they think is constitutional. The answer, though, is they're not really calling for that either, because I think they know that that position is such an outlier position of which very few people would support. There would be some, but I think very few people in this country, especially if they saw the faces of the suffering individuals on the news every night who were dying in the streets because they weren't allowed health care, I think there's no question the country wouldn't tolerate that. And I think we have a system in place that says we give people health care when they need it, and what we need to do now is finance it.
All right, so let's move to the... And then there's the question of whether or not it's severable from the case. To me, that's not quite as interesting in terms of the implications are rather dramatic one way or another. But I want to. I'm fascinated by the fourth question that they're going to be talking about on Wednesday of this week for an hour and a half, and that is the expansion of Medicaid. Part of the Affordable Care Act expands Medicaid to cover somewhere between 10 and 13 million people, I believe. It will pay the states to do this up to 90 to 95% of the cost, at least for the first 3 or 4 years. There's some belief that ultimately by covering those people, it's going to reduce costs for Medicaid because, of course, preventative care always cuts down the expenses down the road. But this seems to me to be the strangest aspect of this case, because it seems well settled that the federal government can pay the states money to expand a program. Can you tell me what's going on?
Well, I'll give the challenger's argument and then I'll refute it. But the challengers to the law argue that the government, yes, indeed, has power under the spending clause. Again, the Congress has power to spend money for the general welfare, and it has power to spend money and ask the states to do things in order to get that money. No one denies that. And the argument is, by the challengers, that's true, but you can't go too far. You can't use that spending power to coerce us to do something that we would never want to do, but you're wielding this sort of a baseball bat of spending power that makes us do something we don't want to do. And they get that concept from a case called South Dakota versus Dole, which is a case in which the court said in dicta there are limits to Congress's ability to make states do things in return for accepting funding. Didn't spell out in much detail what those limits are, and it's never actually applied that language in any case to say that spending is coercive. So we're in really uncharted territory.
And
is it
the implication with that you can't use money to leverage other things? In other words, like the highway funds, you can't give us, you know, dangle highway funds and say you got to raise our drinking age?
Exactly. The argument has got to be, the argument should be that Congress may abuse its spending power if it says, we'll take away all the money that we give you to fund your educational system unless you lower the drinking age or raise the drinking age to 30, right? Or something like that, something that really didn't seem related. Here, obviously, the correlation between the funds for Medicaid and what the government wants the states to do, which is expand Medicaid coverage, they're very closely related. I see the challenger's arguments here as being more, there's so many funds, so much money at issue, so much money at risk, the entire Medicaid funding is at risk, that even though we don't want to expand it, we can't say no because we'd lose all our Medicaid funding. And that's a coercive use of the spending power. And as I think you've already pointed out, the Obama administration responds in their briefs defending the law. This is the kind of thing we do all the time. We routinely expand programs. We routinely have required changes to Medicaid and Medicare that the states then adopt. The states have never made this argument before. No one's ever accepted this argument before. And here we're paying for 90 to 95% of it. So why is this coercive?
If the plaintiffs prevail, well, even before we get to that, because that to me seems like far more apocalyptic scenario in some. Maybe I'm being a little dramatic, but could the federal government, according to the plaintiffs, shrink the size of Medicaid? I mean, if it's coercive to give them more money, isn't it in some ways coercive to give them less money? I mean, why should they have the ability to expand? Yeah. Why should they have the ability to contract and not expand?
The argument is, well, okay, the government has power to spend money and to make us do things in return for accepting government federal government funds, but it shouldn't use that power in a way that coerces us to do something we would never otherwise do. And I think the concern is keeping the state governments accountable to their people. This is the challenger's argument. So, yes, under that argument, the government could indeed contract Medicaid and Medicare without any constitutional problem, but couldn't expand it. At least in the way that they're doing. Again, the response to that is it's a routine matter for the government to spend money to support programs that then states participate in if they want to. And frankly, if the states feel that this is something their people don't want, they can say no. No state, even of the 26 that have signed onto these briefs, have said they're planning to refuse Medicaid funding because, frankly, the people of the state would hate that. Why would they want?
And the federal government is saying it's all or nothing. You either take the expanded Medicaid or you take no Medicaid.
Exactly.
What are the implications if... I mean, this seems to me that something is quite settled. It's just such a strange part of the case for the Supreme Court to take. What do you think is going on here?
Well, that's a very good question, and one I probably can't speculate as to, because it all depends on what the justices, going through those nine justices' minds. I will say this, there has been some sort of intellectual, academic interest in the spending clause and if there are any limits on it, and maybe the court wants to explore those. I think the court probably thought this was an issue that seemed linked and fairly related to the other issues in the case, and so they might as well take it up when they're taking up the entire case.
When the Supreme Court works, do they look at cases like this or questions like this to say, you know what, one of the justices or a couple of the justices have always been sitting around in the chambers going, the spending clause. I would love to contract the breadth of the spending clause in this fashion, or I'd like to expand it in this fashion. My guess is contract is probably more. I'd like to expand it in this, and they map out how they'll go. First, we would need to address this part of the question. Then we would need to address that part of the question. And then we would be able to address that third or fourth or fifth element of that question. Did they see in this case maybe the first opportunity to answer that, to respond to that first question, to begin to reshape the spending clause?
I certainly think that's possible. And we know Justice Thomas, who's been very forthright about this and very consistent, would like to contract Congress's power. At least, you know, I'm pretty clear on where he would be on that question. And he may well have been somebody who was pushing for this issue to be addressed by the court. It doesn't. You need a majority of justices to win your case, but you don't need a majority of justices to take up an issue. So it could well
you
be that
four to
grant a case, and they may well.
Do they horse trade?
You know, that's a great question. I think there's been some indication of that in the past, but we don't really know. None of us can be there during their conferences when they talk privately with each other. Some of them take notes that we then get to read after the fact. There's always speculation they horse trade, but of course there's no real proof.
So Clarence Thomas says, you know, I've always had this bee in my bonnet about the spending clause, and Alito says, well, you know, if you give me something down the road in this criminal procedure question, you know, we can make a deal.
It could happen, but I have no evidence that it does. It's something we all endlessly speculate about with no real information.
What are the implications if they find this Commerce Clause this limited and find that the mandate is unconstitutional? What are the implications legally, assuming they don't pull one of those Bush v. Gore, like, hey, don't use this as a precedent?
You know, I think the implications are pretty extraordinary, both legally and politically. And the government.
Let's talk legally.
Legally, okay. I mean, I think the legal implications are that there's a limit on the Commerce Clause power that we had not thought existed since 1936, which I believe was the last time the court struck down a major regulation based on the lack of Commerce Clause authority. And, of course, that led to the New Deal programs being in jeopardy. That led to a lot of public pressure on the court, and the court eventually switched and became much more willing to accept Commerce Clause arguments.
And executive pressure on the court. I mean, this is when FDR basically said, how would you guys like five other roommates?
Yes, there was this court packing plan, as you're very well familiar with, which I think would have been a terrible idea. But I think the court responds to public pressure, and it did there. And it decided, we need these programs. The public thinks we need these programs. The elected representatives of the public think we need these programs to help us out of the Great Depression, a major financial catastrophe for the country. And the court stopped getting in the way. And so if this court stood in the way of this piece of legislation, I think it would be extraordinary in that the court would be telling the elected branches of government, despite having passed this law, we're going to say there are things that you cannot do, even though they are directly affecting commerce and our ability to fund the healthcare system in the United States without going bankrupt. And I really fear what would happen from there on forward. It might be the first chink in the armor towards rescinding a lot of legislation that the Congress has passed to try to protect the health, environment, economy of this country.
Yes, the Federalist Society gets their turn at judicial activism, I guess, in that respect.
I was going to say judicial activism is a word that everyone can throw around.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Amanda Frost, professor of law from the American University Washington College of Law, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So continuing our coverage, Families USA Health Action 2014. Joining me now is Dr. John McDonough. He is the director of the Center for Public Health Leadership at Harvard University, an author or a writer, I should say, online on health policy, been involved in many different health fights.
I also wrote a book on the Affordable Care Act called Inside National Health Reform. It's published in 2011.
Great. And we will put a link on ringoffireradio.com. So let me give us your sense of, I mean, as someone who literally teaches health policy, what problem, or I should say, what is our central problem with both delivery and cost of healthcare today? And how will the Affordable Care Act help that and also not address that?
Yeah. Well, we have a number of central problems. We have the problem that not everyone has security and financial protection under the system. And the ACA will go far in closing that deficiency and not completely eliminate it. So there will still be more work to do on that front.
What is open? What is the more work to do?
Well, so for example, after the ACA is fully implemented, we will still have somewhere around 25 to 30 million Americans who still don't have health insurance coverage. And how do we deal with that? I think even more importantly, with the affordability structure for people who go into the exchanges and get subsidized coverage, that the structure of both premium support and cost-sharing protection is really not adequate for an awful lot of people who will be looking to it for coverage. I worked in Massachusetts on the creation of Massachusetts health reform. If you compare the affordability protections in Massachusetts with the affordability structure in the ACA, what you find is that the Massachusetts structure was far more generous in terms of how much people had to pay in premiums and how much they had to pay potentially out of pocket than is the ACA. The ACA strove to be where Massachusetts was and found, because of the scores of the Congressional Budget Office, that was too expensive. So right now what we've got is we've got many, many more people who are signing up for Medicaid than are signing up for coverage through the exchanges, even though only half the states are part of Medicaid,
right,
and all 50 states are part of the exchanges. And why is that? I believe that some significant part of that discrepancy is because a lot of people are looking to it and finding that it's still not affordable for them. Uh-huh. And so my sense is that one of the challenges going forward for people who support the ACA is to is to reopen and readdress and restructure the affordability structure to make it more legitimately affordable for the people who are looking to that now as their only option for coverage.
Okay, because I mean, there's been a lot of reports that of those who have purchased insurance on the exchanges, on the private exchanges, about only one third were people who did not have health insurance before.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so
Too early to say, but you suspect
that at least there's a certain percentage of people who are reluctant because simply we still have not achieved affordability yet. And so is this a question in terms of structure of simply adding more subsidies or tax credits?
Yes.
That's it. It's as easy as that.
Well, and lowering the extent to which people are exposed to significant cost sharing. Co-payments, deductibles, co-insurance,
okay,
that kind of thing. So both sides, you have to look at both sides of the equation, seems
so
to me.
Now, so the first side is to increase subsidies. The second part would be to say from a regulatory structure, like, look, you know, just like we say, this is a minimum floor in which your the quality of your coverage cannot drop. We're also going to sort of raise we're going to cap how much copays or deductibles
can be. Right now, you get subsidies for the premiums between the low level, 138%, up to 400% of poverty. You only get protections on the cost-sharing side up to 250% of poverty.
The cost-sharing side?
Cost-sharing.
Oh, cost-sharing.
The
okay.
cost-sharing okay. side, but up to 250. And a lot of people in that 138 to 250 look at the cost-sharing protections and say it's still not affordable for me in terms of what I have to pay out of pocket before I can get medical services. So part of it would be going back and addressing cost-sharing protections for people under 250, but also expanding it up further because those folks above 250 need some protection as well. And, you know, the truth is I think it will be achievable without blowing up the financial structure of the law, because the truth is there are going to be a lot fewer people enrolling in Medicaid than was projected originally, and there are going to be fewer people in the exchanges. So
that's interesting.
So that provides
why are there fewer people in the exchanges? Simply because just by choice.
I think by choice, but
okay.
I think it's largely the choices because they're looking at the choices and saying, you know, I appreciate that I now have some choices that I didn't have before, but quite honestly, at the end of the day, they're still not affordable for
that,
me.
That would be pretty ironic if the the refusal by Republican, largely Republican, I think almost exclusively Republican governors, to expand Medicaid, that it opened the door to increase subsidies in the private exchanges because of the savings where you have the half the amount of people you thought you were going to have in Medicaid based on those projections, right? I mean, that's what you're arguing in terms of where the cost savings are going to be.
I'm not sure where the Republican governors come into this.
Well, they're the ones who wouldn't expand Medicaid.
Yeah.
And so they saved the federal government the money.
Right, exactly.
And that money could be shifted over to enhance the
to make
affordability.
The subsidies more affordable, yes. Right. Definitely.
So now you also said that, you know, it's still by design is the wrong way to construe it, but there were still 25, 30 million people who,
by the end of this decade, who will still be uncovered.
Who will they be?
So about 40% will be people who are eligible for Medicaid but haven't signed up. And now that's not necessarily a terrible thing because those people, when they show up at a hospital emergency room or a community health center, will actually be able to get signed up on the spot. So we would like them to sign up ahead of time and get preventive services and other things that they need. But the truth is that if they really need urgent medical care, they will be able to get coverage on day one when they show up. So that's number one. The second largest group are undocumented immigrants who are not eligible for coverage, about 25%. And then the remainder fit into two buckets. One are people who can afford to buy health insurance, choose not to, and say, I'm going to pay the penalty. Massachusetts, we have every year about 40,000 people who say, I'm not going to buy health insurance, I'll pay the penalty on my taxes. That is their choice. They're not breaking the law. They're conforming with the law and taking one of the two paths available. They pay the penalty. They get nothing for it, but they're in compliance with the law. And the other group, the smaller group, but a significant number still, are people who will legitimately still not have an affordable coverage option available to them. And it's one of the groups, again, that needs to be the focus of attention moving forward.
So they will be less sort of like consciously choosing to, yes, to pay the penalty, and more just sort of by default.
They are offered employer coverage, and it's nominally affordable to them, but in fact they can't afford it because of other requirements in their lives. And so there will still be a group of people who don't have coverage because they feel they don't have an affordable option available to them, even through these coverages, or they may not be eligible because they have employer coverage available to them is defined as affordable.
All right. So I want to sort of shift gears here, because we know that Vermont is at least attempting to head towards a single-payer system.
That's a good way to put it, attempting to head.
Yes. They have yet to figure out a funding mechanism or agree on a funding mechanism.
That's the key.
And there's some talk, you know, one of your gubernatorial candidates, at least in the Democratic primary, I think Don Berwick has floated the idea of a single payer. What if you were to advise Vermont, let's put aside the politics that have to take place, but you were to advise Vermont on how to finance, the best way to finance a single payer system, what would that be?
Well, they're doing some major behind-the-scenes, heavy, deep-dive analysis of the financing options for how to make this work. One of the things that's important, so you need taxes. You need some form of taxes to replace health insurance premiums. You come up with some nice way to say it so that you don't call it taxes, but it's essentially a tax. The key piece, the key ingredient is that whatever tax you put in place has to be eligible for the preferential tax treatment that employer health insurance premiums get. Otherwise, the state will be absorbing a huge loss by the loss of the coverage subsidy that comes through the tax treatment of employer-provided health insurance.
Can you walk me through that?
So I don't know if you get health insurance through an employer or not.
I get it through a union.
You get it through a union. Okay. So the premiums that you pay and premiums that your union pays or however it's financed are not treated as taxable income to you. And that lowers then, depending upon your tax bracket, the effective amount of money that you pay for your health insurance, you and your union pay for your health insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? That is the largest what's called tax expenditure in the federal government, of about $350 billion a year.
It's right.
Bigger than the home mortgage interest deduction, and that's the second largest, okay? So if you just get rid of employer-based coverage and say we're going to go to a fully tax-financed system, the financial benefit to the state through the federal tax treatment of health insurance, you have to structure it in a way so that you hold on to the dollar
what
value
is,
of that
what
is deduction.
What is the benefit to the state by the way that the federal tax code treats health expenditures? You mean just like literally when the state provides health insurance?
Or? So it's like, let's just say that if the cost to your union and to you and all the people like you in Vermont, let's say that was about $750 million, okay? And if...
And that reduces all of our taxable income.
Right. And if it were treated as taxable income and didn't get the deduction, let's say the cost to Vermont would be, say, $1 billion, okay? So you'd have to raise $1 billion in taxes to replace $750 million in premiums, and you're already $250 million behind the eight ball. So part of the question is, can you structure...
So there's two costs associated with providing single-payer health insurance.
Right.
One is the health insurance.
Yes.
And the other is the you've just taken away a tax break.
You've taken away a tax break, and what you mean is then that Vermonters, if you can't do it that way, then Vermonters are shelling out right from step one, $250 $1 million more than they would if you just did it the old-fashioned way.
I see. So just to rephrase, one-third of the health insurance actually costs us in taxable dollars one-third less than we think it does.
Yeah, it depends on your tax. So if you're in the 15% tax break, instead of a policy costing you $10,000, it costs really $8,500.
Right.
If you're in the 33%, it costs $6,700 rather than $10,000. And it's enormous and significant. So whatever they do in Vermont, they have to make sure they hold on to that element. And that's one of the pieces they're working on very hard.
And so they have to figure how do you create that money? I mean,
it depends. It depends what you call the new assessment and where it's located in your code. But the challenge is this, is that doing it in a way that preserves the federal tax deductibility might make it politically less palatable to the public when they hear about it.
I see.
Because the public doesn't want to hear that it's new taxes. And plus the other piece is, you pay your piece of your premium and your union pays the rest. For the most part, you think it's about what you pay and not the whole ball of wax. And that's the way it is for most people who get coverage through their employer.
I don't pay attention to the money that's coming in.
So what happens with single payer is you take something that people, for the most part, don't see, and then you put it all out there in all of its glory with the full cost, and then people are going to say, well, that's too damn expensive. I can't do that. That's crazy.
So what happens in Vermont is going to be very important.
Very important bellwether.
Of how it is rolled out to the public, how they find the resources for it. I mean, presumably it's going to be the providing of health insurance through a single-payer system is going to end up being more cost-effective, significantly more cost-effective.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But it's hard to know how much of that savings you will have, right?
Right.
And so you're going to over-collect at the first.
If we can make it work there, it doesn't mean we can make it work anywhere. If we can't make it work there, it's going to be hard to make it work anywhere else. So this is a very important experiment. And what we see, this is part of the glory of U.S. health policy. It shifts from the feds decide to do something and they suck up all the oxygen in the room. Then they're done. And then it flips back and states start doing all kinds of experiments, right, left, center. And so we're seeing that, and not just in Vermont. We're seeing it in Maryland, in Massachusetts. A whole new generation of experimentation is going on right now, mostly on the cost side.
For you as a health policy expert, what is the other – tell me another – what you consider the most interesting experiment that's happening in
Maryland, without doubt.
And what is it that they're doing that's so...
So Maryland was the first state in the early 1970s and at one point became part of a large number of states and is now the only state still doing it that got approval to pay all their providers, hospitals, by the same set of standards and rules, whether you're in Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance. So it's called an all-payer system. They've been running it since the 70s. It has had some significant successes. So, for example, you don't see the wild variation between what gets paid to a doctor for a Medicare enrollee versus a Medicaid enrollee versus private insurance.
So as it stands in other states, if I'm getting my knee replaced and I'm on Medicare, it's going to cost X.
Who knows?
If I'm getting my knee replaced on in Medicaid, it's going to cost Y.
Yes.
And if I'm in the private insurance, it's going to cost Z.
And it's all over
we don't
the
even
map.
Know.
It's all over the map.
Right. And
So Maryland has had a system where they've had uniformity and structure and consistency and transparency. It hasn't done as well holding down the rate of cost growth, but it has had other benefits as well. So when Maryland has just gotten approval 2 weeks ago from the federal government, imagine their old system. It's like a 75 Chevy or something like that. It's pretty old and rusty, okay? So they're taking the whole car off the chassis, and they're building a whole new car on top of that chassis that is really forward-thinking in terms of moving aggressively quickly away from paying hospitals fee-for-service rates, moving toward global payment systems, accountable care, and really building in a preventive focus in terms of their reimbursement so that not just readmissions or infections, but a whole family of bad things that happens in hospitals. Hospitals are now going to be financially accountable for that, a major effort at paying for outcomes that is, frankly, right now, the most fascinating, interesting experiment going on in the country right now, just getting underway.
So they've had this formula for years. That is basically a formula which pushed the transparency at least and added some rationality, if not cost savings.
Yes.
But now they're going to another level where they're building in where they're trying to create very specific incentives.
Yes,
with that formula.
It's a little bit like they've gone from being a Denny's. They've now gone to being kind of an Asian fusion restaurant and stuff. It's a whole different model, but inside the same building. With different purposes, different outcomes, different goals. Very exciting. Maryland's the state to watch right now.
Dr. John McDonough, Director of Center of Public Health Leadership, thanks so much for your time
you bet.
Today.
Great to see you.